My next guest is a renowned chef and writer. His life was turned upside down nearly 20 years ago when he was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. Instead of succumbing to the effects of this debilitating disease, he picked himself up and began a new life by moving from Seattle to Dingle in County Kerry. His new book, Chef Interrupted, Discovering Life's Second Course in Ireland with Multiple Sclerosis, is a warm insight into the reality of living with MS. And Trevis Gleeson is with me in studio. You're very welcome to the programme.
Well, thank you very much for having me, lad.
Now, maybe you could tell us a little bit about MS, because you have a way of describing it, if you like, to the layman.
Well, I suppose I'm of a certain age that I can get away with this, and I use the old telephone wires. I know that we're all mobile and cordless society now, but many of us will remember the telephone wires, right? And so if I think of my brain as one telephone and every part of my body connected with another telephone, there's the same telephone wires that we used to see along the streets and things, right? They're rubber insulated copper that transmits the signal. So with multiple sclerosis, for some reason, and it's not quite yet known, the immune system strips away that insulation and the conductive copper, if you will, rusts. It sclerosis, it scars.
Okay.
That's what sclerosis means, scars.
So this insulation is called the myelin sheath.
Right, exactly.
I know this. But multiple sclerosis can be very, very debilitating and very, very quickly, but sometimes it goes into remission. And does the myelin sheath rebuild itself and then disintegrate again, or what happens?
No, so the scars, sclerosis, as I said, means scars. So when that wiring is exposed, it corrodes, and so the signals have a hard time passing there. You can imagine what those telephone conversations sounds like. Maybe staticky, maybe you hit every other word, maybe it's gone for a while, maybe it's gone forever. So that's how that works. But yes, myelin can remyelinate. So the nerve sheaths can do that sometimes. The problem is if the inflammation that, you know, you burn yourself, you get a blister. That's inflammation.
Yeah.
Same thing happens around those nerve fibers, and those can be damaged irrevocably if you don't take care of the inflammation part. Now, that's the first stage of the disease. About 80% of people are diagnosed with relapsing and remitting forms of the disease. There are primary progressive, which is a whole different non-inflammatory disease, probably a part of a family of diseases is MS. And then there's secondary progressive, where that inflammatory stage with the disease sort of stops, and then it's just a slow progression at that point, and then there's atrophy of the brain and things like that happen. About 9,000 people live in Ireland with MS.
And what form do you have?
Mine is now, pardon me, secondary progressive.
Okay, so it's a slow burner, but it's there all the time.
It is getting worse. Certainly, see, now I probably had symptoms for about 15 years before I was diagnosed. But like many men, I would ignore them, or maybe a few would be misdiagnosed and things like that. Now, whether I would have wanted to know back at the time, because when I first experienced symptoms, there were no treatments, no medications to slow the progression. So I was a navigator at the time in the Coast Guard in America. I would have been discharged medically. I would have been told to get ready to be in a wheelchair. So there was nothing. It was diagnosed and adios.
So ignorance was bliss for that period.
In a way, for a lot of people, it wasn't, because it was really bad and they were being told it was all in their head. Figuratively, and it was literally, it was in their head.
Now, when did you have to take account of your symptoms? I mean, what was happening? First of all, I should ask you, by the way, about the transition from the Coast Guard to being a chef, because that's a fairly dramatic change anyway.
It was. I suppose I've always enjoyed food. When I was young, I grew up in Michigan in America, in a very, I say, a homogenous town in a very white bread time. And food was a way to experience things outside of my neighborhood, if you will. So I always appreciated food. And when I was on ships in the Coast Guard, my very first ship, there was an amazing set of cooks, and they really were good. And it was a dirty job boat. It was a buoy tender. So we would pick up buoys and their anchors, and it'd be covered in slime and sludge and all that. But the morale on that ship was brilliant because we had great food. And then I moved to another ship out of Alaska, a pretty ship. It was great, you know, slick and all that, but the cooks weren't all that good. And the morale was a whole different thing. So that's when I started to realize just how important food can be in someone's daily life. So when it came time for me to leave the Coast Guard, I decided that was going to be my profession. I went to culinary school.
And so far, you'd only been a gifted amateur, you know, picking up the pot.
Friends might not have been saying gifted, but it was a passion. Yeah. I enjoyed it.
And did you do formal training then?
I did. I went to New England Culinary Institute in Vermont. I studied under a gentleman who later became a French Master Chef of the Year and things like that. So, yeah, it's Michel Laborne.
And what was it like going in, not knowing anything properly and being surrounded by other students who I'm sure had aspirations to that Michelin star?
Oh, they definitely did. And they, most of them had much more experience than me. I was coming, I did a, I got out of the Coast Guard in August and school didn't start until November. So I went, and Vermont is where the school is, and it's very well known for its autumn foliage and things like that, and pre-skiing, things like that. So I took a job in a very busy town, in a very busy hotel, doing lunch service and dinner service, and I would work doubles and triples sometimes and split shifts, and it was just, you know, just immersing myself so that I knew what I didn't know, so that I would know what I would have to focus on when I did get to school.
And you have to learn the language of the kitchen, although in the Coast Guard you knew how to swear anyway, I'm sure.
Well, we won't say it on the radio. Like.
But what happened then was, I mean, you accelerated. Talk about, it's almost as if you knew that life had some misfortune in store for you, because you accelerated very rapidly through the ranks of the cooks.
Well, you know, I think it was probably for the same reason that I jumped in where I did. As you said, there were so many people that had so much more experience, often younger than me. I felt like I had to stack up as much experience as possible. So I was working two and three jobs at a time and trying to get a really broad feel of what the profession was. So I was catering. I was tutoring students. I was acting as a lunch chef. I was doing a lot of different things at once. So as you do that, I suppose – Every door you open gives you possibilities for more doors down the hall.
But you open them as quickly as possible.
I suppose I did.
Yeah. And then you are now, at this point, reasonably well known. You're very accomplished. You're, as you say yourself, a teacher as well as a practitioner. And then the beginnings of maybe there's something wrong with me.
Well, I suppose people who certainly studied under me and worked under me maybe thought there was something wrong with me from the get-go. But, yeah, I started to have these little symptoms that, as I said, you just sort of ignored when you can. Maybe it's an American thing or maybe it's a male thing, but if it's not broken and it's not bleeding, we're not going to go to the doctor. And there were, like I said, even back into the days of the Coast Guard, there were things that were misdiagnosed. And I'm not going to blame a doctor for that. It's, the symptom would come and then it would go away. But by the time that it really hit, I thought I was having a stroke, quite frankly. And so I finally did go to see the doctor, and the doctor knows that something was wrong. And I knew from the moment that I walked in there, first off, that I was able to get an appointment that day. Unlike here, it is very difficult. And this doctor was well sought after. So I got in that day, and I could see the urgency on his face. And so I was in an MRI that night, and by the next day, I was diagnosed.
He knew. He was so experienced that he knew. The MRI was to confirm what he really suspected.
It really was. You know, I lived in an area by this point north of Seattle, which was MS is probably more prevalent in that area of America than it is just about anywhere else.
Why?
Yes. If I knew that answer, I'd probably be in Stockholm collecting the Nobel. There's a lot of factors that we're just not sure about with MS. It probably has something to do with the lack of vitamin D. Because a particular hormone of vitamin D that we get from the sun attaches and modulates the immune system. And it's the immune system, as I said, that attacks with multiple sclerosis. Yeah.
And in your case, you do describe yourself as the absolute Celt. I mean, skin that's almost blue rather than white.
That's it.
And hair that at this stage is not any longer red, but at one point in your life was.
Sure, I was a ginger when I was young and freckle-faced and blue-skinned and sunburned like a lobster and all that, yeah. So,
The consequences of the diagnosis then, I mean, your marriage fragmented, but it's almost as if you decided that this was not a fate you wanted for your wife.
I spent years in therapy to figure that out, but there you go. It probably was. I probably left because I was afraid of who I was going to be. See, by that point, I suppose, and getting very personal here, but I had believed the persona that had ballooned around me. And so I think I believed that I wasn't someone who was going to be lovable. I was going to be a burden and sort of pulled away from that, I think.
You didn't want to be a burden on her.
I think so.
Yeah. But making what is a recovery in terms of your spirit, which is the most important kind of recovery, why Dingle?
Have you not looked around the place?
I love Dublin. Yes, I do.
Well, so I suppose it was why Ireland. And I had always, growing up where I did, there was only one other lad in my class who was of Irish descent at all. And I understand my people left in 1690. I'm as Irish as a mutt is a wolf. But there was this otherness being there and being of Irish descent. So I had always felt a connection somehow. And I think a lot of the diaspora, if you can even call me that at that point, feels that. Certainly the Irish Americans do. But a girlfriend at the time, a dear friend still, brought me as a Christmas gift in February 1 year. And I thought it was a trip of a lifetime, the one time, because my MS was getting worse. Yeah. And it's sort of, Ireland's one of those places that it'll stick with you like a raspberry seed in your wisdom tooth. And so it was just always there to come back.
Yeah. You say that there's a smell from Ireland. Now, I know people will draw certain conclusions about, muck spreading on the land. Yeah. At a certain time.
Well, that's a healthy smell, though, by.
But what is the smell of Ireland? That not those stinky smells, but the smell.
Well, for an American coming into this country, particularly when you go into the rural areas, and particularly the months that I would come, because I always came between November and February, number one, because it was less expensive to travel. But the smell of burning turf as you come into a town is something that people who live here, the Irish, probably are used to on some level. But it is a smell of home that I never experienced. It was one of those things that I felt like I was supposed to know this from the beginning.
Yeah. I don't know what the weather in Seattle is like. I suspect it's not too different to the weather you might find on the east coast of Ireland, rainy and all the rest. But Kerry is different. I mean, you've got a different quality of water.
Quality and quantity, yeah. I suppose it's very similar, certainly in temperature. Maybe if we were to take Seattle's temperature and just squash it a bit, it doesn't get quite as hot in West Kerry as it does in Seattle in the summer, but not quite as cold in the winter. But I would say the wind, the driving of the wind is certainly different back west than it is in Seattle.
How did you then make a crust in Dingle? I mean, did you continue your teaching activities? Did you continue anything related to your cooking career?
Well, when I came in 2005-06 for the winter, which is related in the book Chef Interrupted there, I just came to sort of live the dream while I could. Yeah. It was something that I always thought that I might like to do, that expat life, and some treatments had slowed the progression of MS for a little bit, so I took that window of opportunity when I did. But for such a small town, and for me being who I was or wasn't, whatever, the people of Dingle certainly welcomed me. I was maybe the token Yank. I'm not quite sure back then, but it was, you know, it was sort of the.
But you're even in Dingle, you would have been a well-known foodie.
I suppose I was at the time, just because of where I was going, to Jerry Kennedy's Butcher Shop, to O'Connor's Veg, to the shops, to the fishmongers, things like that. So and certainly some of the things that I was ordering, and when I did finally leave, the box that I brought down to several of the shops with the truffle oil and the wild mushrooms and things like that I couldn't take home. So I suppose that they did know that. And a couple of years later, when I brought my new wife back on our honeymoon, it was very fun to we would walk into a shop and people said, "Geez, where you been?" And my wife was like, "It's been 5 years. Where, how do these people remember you?"
And that is the way it is. Now, the book itself, it does contain recipes.
It does. I suppose if I'm going to host folks into my life, into the cottage, as I call it, I suppose I should give them a few recipes. Now, they are recipes that are fairly standard and traditional Irish recipes. When I wrote the book for American publication, that was something that, you know, a lot of people didn't know how to make a wheaten bread or a proper scone or whiskey blood orange marmalade, things like that. So I did that. But I think that even for the Irish, there's an American twist to how they're made that might be sort of interesting.
Yeah. And you had to ask permission from one of the contributors of a recipe before it was allowed to be put into print.
It's the truth. There was it was a recipe for the wheaten bread that comes from a wonderful woman up in Enniskillen, near where my family comes. And so she gave me the recipe a number of years back, but told me I could never print it in a recipe book or anything like that. But when it finally came around, I did get permission. And so even my mother never got the recipe until the book came out.
Yeah. So how long has Dingle been your home?
We moved there on a more or less permanent basis in November of 2012. So,
we're heading up on five years.
Yeah, yeah.
And no regrets.
None whatsoever. When we first got there, I said to my wife, I said, don't you just love this town? And she said, I like it a lot. And then that's when I realized that this was my dream. It sort of pulled me up short. Yeah. And this was my dream that she was facilitating. And a few weeks later or something, I sort of checked in. I said, how are we doing with you and Dingle? And she said, you know, Dingle and I are dating. And then eventually it was where we're in a committed relationship. And then she came one day. We don't even remember what it was, but she came in the house. She dropped her bags from the shopping. And she said, I love our town. It's just, we have been welcomed to Dingle far deeper, far faster than we ever had any right to hope. And we hope that we're a part of the community. We don't try to be expats living there. We try to give back because it's a welcoming community. It has been for centuries for those who are willing to see it for what it is and hopefully maybe make it a better place too.
Well, it's a wonderful book. It's called Chef Interrupted, Discovering Life's Second Course in Ireland with Multiple Sclerosis. It's published by the Collins Press. It's out now. It's priced around €13. And its author, Trevis Gleeson, thank you very much for joining us.
Pat, thanks a million.